disproportionate effect on women exercising the vote that they fought so long to achieve. That's Thursday, August 26th at 5 to 6 p.m. Let's celebrate and prepare to finish what we started. Women are wanting to vote.
To all the low riders, the big riders. Yeah. What happened in the car, yo?
This is Mama Soul. I, the law, and DJ Black Icon 11111 want you to ride along with us, the Harlem Connection. We've got your soundtrack for Wind in Your Hair, groove-filled summer drive. So join us this Friday, 10 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and WBAI.org. If you missed an episode or want to replay one, check out the Harlem Connection on the WBAI archives.
The keys to the Jeep.
And the previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up at the 7 p.m. hour. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
And it's now 7 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York. And that means it's time for another edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. From Billy Bomb for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. From Billy Bomb.
And it's another exciting edition of Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I'm here.
And over in Skype land, where my voice always changes. Skype land, we have Alex, who apparently is muted. Oh, there you are. Okay. You're on a long delay tonight.
No, I was on unmuting myself, and then switched to the light.
Is someone playing a video game in your house? Because boy, you're not sounding that great. I would check your connectivity.
Okay. Yeah. I'm out right now. So let me shut up for a little.
Barely make out anything you're saying.
You are on Earth, though, right,
yeah,
Alex?
I don't even know.
That's.
If he wasn't on Earth, we'd hear him a lot clearer.
You think it would be better if it was coming from like outer?
Alex, do some troubleshooting. Rob T. Firefly, welcome.
Good evening.
And Gila.
Hello.
We were not on last week, but we are on now, and we're going to make up for it. We have overtime coming up at 8 o'clock. You can go to our YouTube channel, Channel 2600, or just click on the link on the main page of 2600.com. Meet us there at 8 o'clock. You can make phone calls or listen to this hour where you can't, because we're broadcasting from all sorts of remote places trying to catch up with various news. Here's some good news. I always like to start with good news whenever possible. Cryptocurrency platform Poly Network said on Monday that almost all of the $610 million stolen this month in one of the biggest crypto heists has now been returned by the unknown person or persons behind the attack. Yeah, who says hacking doesn't have honor? In a Twitter post, Poly Network said it had regained control of all the assets except for $33 million in stablecoin. Okay, I'm trying to understand what I'm saying here. A stablecoin Tether, is that a thing? Does anybody know? Nobody knows? Okay, we're all ignorant here.
Tether.
You know something, Alex?
Yeah, can you guys hear me all right?
Barely.
All right, yeah. Tether is a coin that is pegged to the value of the U.S. dollar and is backed by certain other types of assets, as I understand.
Okay, well, the network said it was in talks with Tether about unfreezing the funds. The hackers had previously said they did the attack for fun. Nothing like doing something for fun that carries over $600 million with it. They did that to expose a vulnerability in the platform's digital contracts. I'd say they found one. It was always their plan to return the tokens. Some blockchain analysts have speculated they just found it too difficult to launder so much stolen cryptocurrency. You know, it's always somebody there, you know, to cast aspersions and to say that their intentions were not good. Look, they returned a lot of it, most of it, the vast majority of it. If they kept $33 million, I don't know if that's such a big – that is a big deal. A lesser-known name in the world of crypto, Poly Network is a decentralized finance platform that facilitates peer-to-peer transactions with a focus on allowing users to transfer or swap tokens across different blockchains. But I'm sure they never intended for the tokens to be swapped like this. I guess it's a happy ending, right? I mean, they're still out $33 million, but I guess that's nothing compared to what we were facing, or they were facing.
Yeah, and look, I think that part of the lesson here, too, is, and this is something that we've been saying for a while, and I hope you guys can hear me a bit better.
Much better.
Is this any better? Okay, good. It is actually very difficult to launder significant amounts of cryptocurrency and turn it into fiat currency, turn it into real money that you can use in the real world. It's hard to push these things through what would be known as coin swappers or tumblers that push these coins through and make it very, very difficult to trace because you're turning them into other different types of coins, other currencies, and essentially putting it through a clearinghouse type of effect. But there's lots of new heuristics that you can use to identify residual bits of coins. There's lots of different tracing mechanisms that are out there. And I'm actually working on a couple of different matters right now where we're tracing cryptocurrency that was stolen and having a great deal of success with it. It's just sometimes very difficult to claw it back in a reasonable period of time. But finding cryptocurrency edged out into fiat currency can be, you know, really, really difficult. I would venture to say that these ransomware attackers, people that are doing ransomware as a service, or the Reevils or the R-Evils, and they probably, I would guess, maybe take 10 or maybe 15% of whatever their haul is in cryptocurrency out into the real world.
Alex, let me ask you, as someone involved in this, do you find it harder to be able to retrieve funds that have been stolen or funds that somebody has managed to lock themselves out of, either by forgetting a password or losing a hard drive or having a corrupted hard drive or various things like that?
Well, if in certain instances, I think it's nearly impossible to get funds back if they've lost the keys to a wallet. There are certain things, though, that depending upon how the cryptocurrency works and the smart contracts that underlie the cryptocurrency work, you may be able to do certain things like make a notation on the currency itself that was lost that indicates that it's essentially blacklisted or it's banned from any future use or being transferred, at which point, once that cryptocurrency is banned or sunk, you may be able to have an exchange or a coin reissued for that particular currency. But the exchanges and the platforms that run these coins, they don't like to do that often. And it's a very long and burdensome process to prove that you are, in fact, the owner of those particular coins. It's pretty rare, but it does get done. And I think that it's harder to get that done in a situation where you may have just lost the coins as opposed to tracing out coins, because there are certain ways where you can trace with damn near certainty the route that certain stolen funds have taken from the victim through various coin swapping services or Tumblr services, you know, and find where they and actually freeze them where they end up before they are further transferred or edged out into fiat currency or pushed out through an over-the-counter service. So in the situation of theft, I feel like it's easier to make that case.
Is there anything you could advise people who are maybe just dipping their toe into the world of cryptocurrency, mistakes not to make, ways to ensure that their funds don't go missing or get lost or get corrupted or anything like that, types of backing up that makes sense, things that they shouldn't do?
I think there's a lot of common sense that goes into this, and you know, how you treat your wallets and you know, very hard passwords. Use some kind of passphrase as opposed to a password. Don't use passwords that you've used elsewhere to secure your cryptocurrency wallets. But I think a really great piece of advice these days especially is to be very, very wary of scams that involve cryptocurrency, phishing scams, voicemail scams, smishing scams, SMS scams. There is a massive amount of energy and activity directed towards stealing others' cryptocurrencies, especially from some of the larger exchanges. And this is the kind of activity that I watch in the DNS, in the domain name system, every day. And the volume and velocity of phishing attacks targeting cryptocurrency holders, I think because there are more and more cryptocurrency holders every day, and a lot of people aren't necessarily that familiar with the types of scams or how they work, or the mechanics of various KYC or know your customer requirements from all of these exchanges, that can be exploited very, very easily for a new user or a new holder of cryptocurrency. So be very, very careful of these scams.
Be very careful of those acronyms, Alex, because KYC pronounced says kick, and I don't think that's what you want to do to your customers.
I know you love that KYC acronym, right? You know.
Okay. Hey, well, we've got a really interesting story here that we're going to be devoting some time to, involving the Taliban. Yeah, they've seized U.S. military biometrics devices that could aid in the identification of Afghans who have assisted coalition forces. Current former military officials have told The Intercept the devices are known as HIDE, H-I-I-D-E, Handheld Interagency Identity Detection Equipment. They were seized last week during the Taliban's offensive. That's according to a joint special operations command official. And three former U.S. military personnel, all of whom worried that sensitive data they contained could be used by the Taliban. By the way, that was actually 2 weeks ago. The story I'm reading is about a week old. Hide devices contain identifying biometric data, such as iris scans and fingerprints, as well as biographical information, and are used to access large centralized databases. It's unclear how much of the U.S. military's biometric database on the Afghan population has been compromised. It was billed by the U.S. military as a means of tracking terrorists and other insurgents, but now biometric data on Afghans who assisted the U.S. has also been widely collected and used in identification cards. According to a U.S. military contractor, we processed thousands of locals a day, had to ID, sweep for suicide vest, weapons, intel gathering, etc. Hide was used as a biometric ID tool to help ID locals working for the coalition. And this is really shocking. We know the U.S. military has long used these devices in the so-called war on terror and used biometrics to help identify Osama bin Laden during the 2011 raid on his Pakistani hideout. According to investigative reporter Annie Jacobson, the Pentagon had a goal to gather biometric data on 80% of the Afghan public to locate terrorists and criminals. And now those devices have fallen into the hands of the Taliban. So you can imagine what that could mean for people's safety. We have on the line with us Will Byrne, the director of Human Rights First Innovation Lab, who knows a thing or two about what is going on here. Will, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a big deal, is it not?
It is. We are very concerned about multiple different ways that the Taliban are using technology. But the advent of biometric data that could be in their hands at a relatively large scale across Afghans in the country is unprecedented, certainly in a humanitarian situation like what we're facing in Kabul.
Do you know how big these devices actually are physically?
Yeah, so the handheld devices, so there's a number of issues and sort of bits of the technology as we understand it that are in play. So the handheld devices were used by coalition forces, and they're essentially like a, you know, almost like a large gun, right? Almost like the size of a super soaker or something. Very strange looking devices. They do have capability of storing some data in the machine that can be pulled from, we are to understand. And so those devices were being used, as you mentioned, to actually create databases of Afghans that were working with coalition forces. So that database, from the standpoint of the Taliban, right, is like a laundry list of the type of folks that they would want to go after. So it's particularly concerning. There's actually quite a bit more data, biometric data, that's out there in Afghanistan on Afghan citizens. The 2019 election used biometrics to register Afghan citizens that were voting. So there are questions on the intelligence right now whether the Taliban actually have access to these databases, so whether they can actually ID people that they're screening through existing cameras and potentially these Hide devices. We are operating as if they have that potential, or they will have that potential. So as a human rights organization, one of the things that makes our organization unique is that we are working with, we post fellowships with technologists working in emerging technology, big data products, et cetera. And we've issued a guideline that really became quite, viral is the word, quite circulated on social media around how activists on the ground and citizens can evade tools like facial recognition and fingerprint as well as iris scan efforts that, mm-hmm. that could be used by the Taliban.
Now, it could be used by the Taliban, a number of sources in this Intercept article actually says that it's quite possible that they would need additional tools to be able to process the data. But if, say, an entity like Pakistan were to help, well, then they could probably do it quite easily. They have these tools. So having these devices, having this data, we might as well assume that they will at some point have access to all the information.
Correct. And that's why we're raising, whether it's via Pakistan, secret security, we know they have the capability, or it's others. It's essentially a Wild West scenario right now in terms of data that is available to the Taliban for use of identification. We have a Saigon level humanitarian crisis unfolding currently in Kabul. People putting their lives in danger in the hundreds or thousands trying to get into the airport, with evacuations imminently shutting down, most likely for Afghans. But Saigon did not have this element at play in terms of this level of ability of a hostile, potentially revenge-oriented power that now has access to could have access to this database and the tools to use it.
You know, so it's one of the things that we keep coming back to on this program is basically imagining technology, both its good aspects and its bad aspects. But we always ask ourselves, well, what if the Nazis had this particular technology? What would they have done with it? And you think of things like databases and just basically technological ways of tracking and finding people. And that might make something that seems like a great advantage into something that could be a terrible nightmare. And I think that's what we're beginning to see right here. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, Will, is these devices are handheld. How were they left behind? How did they manage to fall into the hands of the Taliban?
We wish we had a good answer for that. Is the most direct way I can respond.
I can see you were filtering quite a few possible responses there.
Yeah, it's the pace with which the withdrawal happened was incredibly disorganized, and it's caused all kinds of problems.
Is there a way, perhaps, that these devices can be bricked remotely or accessed in any way, like something that Apple might do?
That's something that we and partners are looking into. It appears to be some companies that could have the power to shut down access to remotely shut down access to some of the data that's in play. So that is something we're working on. It's not an Apple or it's more data security firms that have contracted with the U.S. government. So that is possible. I mean, the other element of this that we're sort of dancing our way toward is, with this issue of retention of biometric data in unstable societies and unstable, political economies this we hope will not result in, really even more tragic outcomes, but hopefully this sends a very clear message that we need policies and protocols in place if we're ever going to be collecting biometric data at this scale for securing remote deletion of that data in instances like this.
I would think that would be something that we would have concluded decades ago, but we always see the stragglers and don't seem to get it until something like this happens. Rob, you had a question.
Yeah, related to all that. Well, thanks for joining us tonight. But I've been thinking about this a lot, and they had to realize that they had, cutting-edge military equipment bought with, the 20-year-long budgets of everything that was being poured into the occupation there. And it seems crazy that no one would have planned some kind of failsafe for, like, what if we leave? Where's the switch that we should pull to make sure that this stuff isn't useful to those who would pick it up after we leave it behind? Or should we bring things with us? Like, in a more perfect world, like, what should they have done when shutting this all down, when leaving to ensure the safety of the people who cooperated with the coalition, or just people in general who might have ended up in these databases?
Yeah, and it's relatively intuitive for once you stop and think about it, right? It's if you are going to put these systems in place in this level of collection and database, you know, you're populating databases like this in an unstable situation where that data could be repurposed for grave harm and humanitarian transgressions, should we say, then as part of a contract, if you're a technology company and the U.S. military is reviewing that contract, it's not just about contracting. The military itself needs to have a clear game plan on a simple and efficient way by which this data can be shut down and deleted from external access. So this is a conversation that needs to be built, right, and grown when it comes to use of biometric technologies.
Yeah,
the other element, just to say it quickly, is that in creating a guide on how, you know, people can try to evade these technologies. For example, if you're walking in the public square and you've got cameras on you with this type of technology operating in the back end, it's very hard. It's very hard to evade these technologies. There's, you know, not to go into too much detail, but even, you know, people think putting a wig or glasses up will work. These are detecting the bone structure of your face and are highly, highly effective. Go ahead.
Did you have something else, Rob?
No.
Okay, Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, Will, thanks for coming on with us. And in full disclosure, I also work with Human Rights First on the Technology Advisory Board, and I would like to invite everybody to take a look at the biometric evasion techniques that Human Rights First has published. They're available on humanrightsfirst.org, and perhaps we can tweet this out or maybe put it in the show notes, because those tactics and techniques for evading biometrics, they're really interesting, because what the document gets into when you dig into it is how effective some of these technologies really are and how difficult they are to evade, as Will had mentioned. But there are also some very simple recommendations for decreasing the probability that you would be detected by a biometric identification like facial recognition systems. Sometimes it's as simple as taking an evasive measure like putting your head down. You know, things like just that easy were kind of surprising to me to see in the document. So there are things I think that we can all take away about evading biometrics if we need to. And quite frankly, Afghans who need to be evacuated, who worked with U.S. forces, are not the only ones facing biometric surveillance on massive scales these days, unfortunately. But Will, I want to ask you and I think what Human Rights First is doing on this front is absolutely great, critical, cutting edge. And I'm not saying that because I'm partial to their efforts. But could you talk to us a little bit more about what Human Rights First in general is doing with respect to Afghanistan on the tech side and elsewhere? Because I think there's a lot of efforts underway, and I think you're involved in quite a bit of it.
Sure. So at a high level, part of what makes the effort of Human Rights First as a human rights organization unique is that we essentially have a incubator of technologists that we're supporting to build with code applications and tools that are useful now in the fight to protect people's human rights. So those tools range in our first cohort. And I should mention, we'll be taking on a second cohort of applicants, and we'll be putting out an open call two technologists to be a part of our next cohort this fall. So would love to work through your all's channels to get the word out too. Right now we have, for example, a computer vision AI tool that is really at the cutting edge of computer vision capability, focused on detecting violence and use of force in video to flag that for human rights violation researchers and journalists and others. We have a number of tools that are being used to counter violent, register and track surface violent white extremists and their networks by scraping across many different data sources online and applying natural language processing and machine learning to identify. So we have that tool working with pretty in tandem with some pretty high profile prosecutions that are underway in that area. And then I should mention, we have a tool that is also using machine learning to track incidents of, basically through language on social media, incidents that are likely related to human rights violations. And that's something that we have in prototype that we're getting ready to apply for monitoring in Afghanistan. And so we're actually scrambling to get translation language capability in place for Pashto and Dari, which is the local languages in place there. But that, unfortunately, we are transitioning now from this sort of evacuation moment to what will most likely be a rolling human rights crisis in Kabul. And so we are looking to apply the best technology we can to speed up our ability to detect where issues are happening. So it's a really, I just started in the role here as someone that's worked in at the sort of intersection of technology and social justice my whole career. It's completely unique what the organization has been able to do and actually attract real technologists and people like you, Alex, to advise us. So really appreciate the opportunity to join you all, and happy to hopefully build the conversation even outside of this recorded one.
Of course, it's so important, the work that you do, and I think that it'll impact a lot of people who are listening. I want to read something from someone else from Human Rights First, Welton Chang, who said, "I don't think anyone ever thought about data privacy or what to do in the event that this Hyde system fell into the wrong hands." Welton Chang, Chief Technology Officer. "Moving forward, the U.S. military and diplomatic apparatus should think carefully about whether to deploy these systems again in situations as tenuous as Afghanistan." I would say, you know, they should have thought of it before they did it this time, because the risks just seem so obvious. Maybe it's because we do a show about this type of thing every single week, but I don't know how they could miss the potential threat of having all this biometric data. I see that 80% of the Afghan population, that was the goal of the Pentagon. And I wonder, you know, is this something that is being rolled out as a test so that they can do it here at some point? I find that usually things are tested first, either on the battlefield or in prisons, before they're rolled out to the general public. And by the time it gets to that stage, they've perfected all of the imperfections, and they've made it palatable so people are willing to give up a little bit of privacy and freedom for the convenience. Do you think that's a realistic scenario, what I'm envisioning here?
Well, forgive the humor, but if that's the case, they're doing a very poor job of branding this technology. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is something that's made it more popular in the eyes of American citizens, I would hope.
I would hope so, too. They've gotten criticism, but, you know, the only real criticism that that I can see here is back in 2011, the Government Accountability Office criticized the Pentagon for not doing enough to ensure that other agencies had easy access to the information that they were gathering. So it wasn't that they were upset that they were doing this and collecting all this biometric information on regular, everyday people. but that they didn't make it easier to share that information through every agency that was interested in looking at it. And I think that, you know, that is the kind of cluelessness, I think, that is the theme here, where they just don't see that this is bad. Collecting all this information and storing all this information is a horrible thing, and I think we're going to see that play out in unimaginable, horrific ways.
Yeah, it's a last thought I'll share on this, and then I'm actually involved in some final pushes on evacuation happening in Kabul, so I need to jump to that. But, you know, there are reasons that there are not just the United States government and governments that are using biometric technology to create this data. NGOs are doing this as well. And in some instances, there's been justification. I mean, the World Food Program had a biometric program that they started for refugee camps. And the logic behind why it's useful makes sense in the instance that you're using it, right? It was logical that the United States would be trying to screen folks they were contracting with in the Afghan population in an unstable wartime environment. It's logical in the case of, you know, sometimes some of these programs are creating identification for people that have lost their financial and legal identity. And they have no record of it because they are refugees, for example. And so there's this notion that it can help with that. That makes sense. But not having a plan in place for what happens with this data, how is it actually secured if the program's completely overrun, is untenable. Can't happen again. And I would agree with Welton that, you know, it may be best practice to avoid collecting it altogether.
Kyle, very quickly, because Will's got to help with the...
I think it just speaks a little bit to the way we characterize a terrorist. Mm-hmm. I mean, the number you were reading was 80%. Was that 80% of the population?
I believe that was correct, yeah.
Amazing, yeah. That it's billed as something to just really organize, control... And reference a database of terrorists, and that's the only implementation for it, and it creeps into, well, most everyone needs to be a part of this just in case, or so we can go back and make sure we don't miss anyone.
But I believe the information also indicated if this person was someone that could be worked with, or someone who was cooperating, and that's the real danger. If I'm not mistaken, that information is also stored as part of the notes on the people. Is that correct, Will?
I believe so.
Okay.
So it's becoming this sort of like universal tool.
Just
that,
a database of everybody. Mm-hmm. Alex, I'm going to give you the last word because Will's got to go.
Yeah, sure. And thanks again, Will, for hopping on. I think this data, if you think about just the ordinary course of business records that the U.S. government is going to be generating in the course of a 20-year occupation, there's going to be paperwork. There's going to be other data and files that are associated with these Afghans that have assisted U.S. contractors. And if those are tied to an identity and then that biometric data becomes available, let's say with the assistance of the ISI or some technically adept members of the Taliban, then it becomes very, very problematic for these Afghans. I mean, if you think about the fact that, you know, this is really a failure of data governance and data retention policies, frankly, if you think about it from a private sector perspective. I mean, what if Afghanistan had its own GDPR? You know, how would we deal with this? This would be a major breach. This happened in the United States. There'd be plenty of state laws that regulate the use of biometric identification technologies, and the release of which would start a flurry of class action lawsuits against whatever contractor this was or whatever private entity this was. But what are you going to do against the government of the United States, especially when it was occupying or at least, you know, residing in Afghanistan for so long? I think the doctrine of sovereign immunity would prevent anybody from seeking redress or legal remedy in the courts of at least the United States. But I mean, I think Afghanistan, this is a case in point. It's crazy to think, though, that when we talk now about Afghanistan passing laws, that we're talking about the Taliban passing those types of laws. So
fat chance that I think data governance and regulation of biometric technologies is going to hit on the legislative agenda anytime soon. Anyhow, Will, I know you've got to jump. It's wonderful to have you here. And unless anybody has any parting comments or questions, I think, you know, we'll let you get back to it. And thank you for your time.
Just on behalf of Afghans, Americans, and people all over the world, thank you for what you're doing. It makes a difference, and we need more of it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. To see you all soon.
All right. Good luck. And that was Will Byrne, the director of the Human Rights First Innovation Lab. And Alex, since you're involved with that organization, can you give website information and ways people can get more information and get in contact and help out, perhaps?
Yes, sure, absolutely. And by the way, I do want to mention that quote from that you quoted from Welton Chang. Welton was on our show, if you recall, maybe about 6 or 7 months ago. He was also from Human Rights First, and so. Pretty funny you picked that quote. Human Rights First, you can find them at humanrightsfirst.org. I think it's a fantastic website. There's a lot of information there you can find, I think, pretty easily. The biometric evasion technique document that Will and I were and the rest of you were discussing this evening on the show, as well as a slew of other information about their campaigns, topics, resources, media initiatives, fact sheets, and a lot of the other efforts underway with respect to the evacuation of Afghans right now. So definitely check it out. They're a great organization to support, and I'm proud to be part of their technology advisory board.
What a mess. What a mess this has turned into. Of course, you know, it's been a mess for 20 years. I remember, you know, just after 9/11, the throngs of people that were trying to stop this, trying to stop an invasion or occupation of Afghanistan. Why? Because it wouldn't work. Because the region, the country has a history of repelling invaders. And this just took longer. I mean, they just got over 10 years of Soviet occupation where they kicked the Soviets out. And now the same thing has happened, but it's far more tragic because of all the waste, of all the militarization that has taken place in response. That's made things so much worse. I hope but hardly expect that there is a lesson that will be learned here. How do you hold out any hope for that when this comes on the heels of Vietnam and all sorts of other misadventures that we really should have learned something from? such a tragedy. And of course, the responsibility falls on everybody. It falls on Joe Biden, but boy, it also falls on George W. Bush. It falls on Barack Obama. It certainly falls on Trump, who made this deal that excluded the Afghan government and just made things a whole lot more difficult, made the Taliban into an equal partner, and that's being forgotten. That's being forgotten. Yes, Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, this whole situation is fascinating in, you know, terrible and heartbreaking ways, and also needs to be, like, we need to keep the receipts from this and learn the lessons that it has to teach us about what is going to happen if we get into another situation like this, and maybe it, you know, goodness willing, it'll prevent us from getting into something like that. But yeah, Afghanistan repelled the Russians. Afghanistan, you know, has a history of this. But this time, we left all our really, really dangerous toys behind, and that's going to have, you know, that's going to keep having effects throughout the coming years on the people that are caught in this database. I mean, I am just fascinated. You know, When I had a day job that ended, they managed to shut off my email and shut off my access to the internal systems, as one expects during these things. And, you know, I don't know if the organizational abilities of the company in question should be directly compared to that of the U.S. Military and everyone else that was involved. But, you know, it's not looking great.
Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing to mention about this particular type of data as well is that it's data about you as an individual person based on your biology. That's why we call it biometrics. That means it's not going to change. That the data in that database
may be passed around to various other governments as well that are friendly to the Taliban. And for these people who are part of that database, it's going to make it easy to track them at the border if they try to, let's say, you know, visit Iran or go into Pakistan. They may be branded as traitors or as collaborators with the great enemy, the United States of America, and perhaps abducted, tortured, mistreated because they were in that database. And so the power of data and the power of data to facilitate human rights abuses is what we're seeing playing out right now. It's absolutely terrifying. And I think it goes back really to what Will was talking about and why Human Rights First is so unique among human rights organizations, because they understand the power of technology, the power that it can be used for good, and the power that it can really be used for absolutely malicious and nefarious purposes. The very types of principles that we address on the show every week are embodied in that organization, and they do a lot of amazing work for refugees, asylum seekers, not just these humanitarian crises, but all throughout the year. There's cohorts of lawyers and private law firms that work with Human Rights First, technologists. The Technology Advisory Board, I think, is absolutely fantastic, and a lot of these innovative projects that are happening right now really show that technology can be reharnessed and used as a force for good, but we have to continually watch to make sure that it's not a force for bad.
But you know, I have a challenge for everybody here. Can you name a single government that exists now or has existed in the past that would not want this database on their citizens? A single one. Because I can't. Every government wants to know who its citizens are, what they are doing, what they're up to, what they are thinking, and wants that verifiable through fingerprints, iris scans, you name it. So it's not going to go away if we rely on their goodwill. It's only going to go away if we rely on our resistance to it. Alex.
Look, I entirely agree. And another interesting bit of technology being used for purposes for which it wasn't ordinarily designed right now is, and our listeners can do this, if they have Snapchat on their phones, if you go into the Snap Map and go to Kabul Airport, the Hamid Karzai Airport, just swipe over to Afghanistan, zoom into Kabul Airport, and you can begin to see these sort of heat map-looking things. And those generally are where people are congregated around the airports. And as you see those heat maps changing, those are indicative of where checkpoints are around the airport if you're trying to get to the airport. I've seen a couple of people and a couple of colleagues post about this and using social media platforms like Snapchat to gather open source intelligence information and data about these checkpoints in Kabul is also incredibly fascinating. And really, I think, an innovative use of open source intelligence.
Wow. Interesting stuff. All right. Let's move on to a couple of other things if we have time for it. There have been some data intrusions. T-Mobile says a hack has exposed personal data of 40 million people. Used to be that was a headline. Remember? Even a million people having their 40 million people. Wow. Basically, names, birthdays, social security numbers. This is why, whenever possible, you lie. You don't give your real information to these companies. They don't protect it. And before you know it, it's out there. And how are you going to change that information? How are you going to hide that information in the future when they're sharing it with the world? T-Mobile said in a statement it had been investigating the data breach since last week, which unfortunately was after it happened. And they were informed of claims made in an online forum that a bad actor had compromised T-Mobile systems. That's how they find out about these things, on online forums. Some of the exposed data includes customers' first and last names, SSNs, driver's license, and other information. It also included the PINs of about 850,000 active prepaid customers. So they got everything, pretty much. The company said it would reset PINs for those prepaid customers and urged other customers to change their PINs as well. And this is the part that really annoys me. it added that it would create a website to help customers take steps to further protect themselves. Like, it was the customer's fault. And I've seen notices that go out to the customers who are affected saying, here are things that you shouldn't do if you want to protect your data. They're not the ones that lost the data. T-Mobile is the entity that didn't have proper security. We should all be sending them a note saying, this is what you need to do better, you know, or maybe be in a different business. It's absurd. Now there's also a report that 70 million customer records from AT&T were breached, almost like a response to this. AT&T is claiming this didn't happen, so it's kind of up in the air. I don't really have much more than that because this is coming off of a blog. The reports are the 70 million customer records were breached in some kind of massive hack. And I guess we still have to find out if that's true and not just rumor mongering. But it's likely. It's possible. It's the kind of thing that happens all the time. And it's why we have to take steps against these companies before we trust them with anything. So use a PO box. Don't use your address. Don't give them your social security number. Give them some other form of ID that you don't mind if it gets out, if you have to even give them that at all. There's nothing wrong with being anonymous. There's nothing wrong with having alternate identities. There's nothing wrong with trying to confuse the system. And I feel that we try to follow the rules a little too much, and it always hurts us. Because these vast companies, they don't care. They don't take precautions. Your data is simply their means to make a profit, and they don't protect that. Yes, Rob.
And what fascinates me about these cases, and especially T-Mobile, AT&T, you know, the telecommunications industry, you'd think if anyone would lock their networks down, but we know better, especially those of us who are phone freaks. But if I personally, as an individual, were responsible for the information, the personal identifying information about 100 million people, and I lost it, I screwed something up, I leaked it out there, I would probably suffer some repercussions for that. I would probably get sued. I might have, charges brought against me, whatever. But, what's going to happen to T-Mobile? What's going to happen to AT&T? Probably nothing, because it really doesn't matter when a company that's made of money and has many legislators that they've bought and paid for in position, they don't get punished for things that they do wrong.
Well, their stock might go down. There might be some profits that won't be as big as they could have been. But you know what? We're talking about T-Mobile. People are hearing about T-Mobile, and they're saying, hey, it's the name of a phone company. I need a phone company, and maybe I'll pick T-Mobile. I mean, what are the odds of having another data breach after you already had one? It's like lightning doesn't strike twice, does it? So you're right. They don't lose. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, look, on the other side of this.
Really?
Too,
you're going to pick another side to this? This is as black and white as it can possibly be. This is the Death Star, literally, that we're talking about.
Come on.
All right, fine. Go ahead.
Well, The Death Star, I mean, yeah, the AT&T logo, the resemblance to the Death Star has always been pretty uncanny, have to say.
Intentional, but I think. That's my theory.
yeah, sorry about that, Thunderbird. But the issue I see here, though, is that we're faulting them for collecting this data, but they need this data in order to bill us and to run their systems, to send out mail, I think a lot of it could probably be minimized.
Why do they need a social security number, Alex? Why in God's name does a phone company need your social security number?
Well, they probably shouldn't be retaining it for purposes other than for which it was originally
retained.
They need
an address to send the bill to. Perhaps. That's all. They don't even need your name. They need an address. They need to just get paid. That's all they need.
But to a certain extent here, I think we do have to be careful about blaming the victim here. I mean, these companies, in as much as they are very much for profit and supposed to be stewards of our data, these are the companies that have been breached in one way or another.
Whoa. When you said the victim, I thought you meant us. You mean they're the victim? We're the victim. We're the ones having our data passed all over the world.
That's true. So there are multiple victims here, but I think we have to realize that the company is also a victim here, that there is an inherent value to the data that was exfiltrated from them for a reason, because people want it out there. They want to use it. There's too much of it out there. I completely agree. And sorry, I'm going to go on mute for a second here.
Okay. That's an unusual way to make an argument, but yeah, look, they basically...
Yep, sorry, I wasn't sure if you had heard that. I had a call coming in through the same computer and using this new microphone thing. It's been weird, but mm-hmm. but yeah, I think, you know, look, these companies were breached. It is a... I think it's a big looming issue that it happens over and over and over again. And it's not enough, I agree, to just say, oh, well, cybersecurity is hard. But it is very difficult when you're warehousing this data to do it properly. I think everybody needs to redouble and recheck what their security controls are. It's not a simple fix by any means, but any exposure of personal identifying information will probably lead to some kind of governmental inquiry. And certainly, as Rob suggested, I think a slew of lawsuits as well.
I just don't think we are wrapping our heads around 40 million people, what that means, how many people that is. I mean, if you added up every Mets game since they came into existence and added the attendance, I don't think you'd reach 40 million. It's that many. I'm not sure about that, yep. But it's a lot of people.
It's like a sixth of the country, right?
Yeah, something like that. It's huge.
A little bit.
And it's not even the biggest. And look, we don't seem to be getting anywhere because we've been reporting these stories for many years now, and it just keeps happening. So I'm tired of buying the argument that, yeah, they're going to get better. I don't think it's in their interest to get better. I really don't, because if it were, this wouldn't be happening over decades. They would have taken this more seriously and not collected so much information about us and allowed it to fall into unauthorized hands so many times. I mean, if as Rob said, if any one of us did that, we'd be looking for another job, we'd be facing charges, all kinds of serious things would happen to us that do not happen to major corporations. I'm sorry, that's going to have to be the last word, except on overtime, which you can join us on in just a few minutes at 8 o'clock. Go to youtube.com/channel2600 or go to the link that's on the 2600.com webpage, and you can call us and talk to us, and we'll be on there in just a few minutes. We lost a major octogenarian drummer in a rock and roll band. There's going to be a lot of octogenarian drummers in the years ahead. Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones. I want to go out with a tribute where he basically played on the only song that has our name in it. So here's our tribute, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Sitting in my bedroom late last night, got in the bed and turned out the light. Decided to call my baby on the telephone. All I got was a ringing tone. It's off the hook. So long, she upset my mind. Why is she talking such a long time? Maybe she's leaving, maybe she's ill. Phone's disconnected, unpaid bills off the hook. It's off the hook. It's off the hook. It's off the hook. It's off the hook. Don't wanna see a afraid of what I find. Tired of letting her upset me all the time. The hook. It's off the hook.
It's off the hook. It's off the hook.
Oh dear, what can the matter be? Dear, dear, what can the matter be? Oh dear, what can the matter be? Women are wanting to vote.
This Thursday, August 26th, is Women's Equality Day and the 101st anniversary of women winning the vote after fighting for it for 75 years. Tune in at 5 to 6 p.m. as Joy of Resistance airs a special show to celebrate that victory and looks at the unfinished business it left behind. We'll play period music, hear readings, and speak with our guests, Professor Ellen Du Bois, author of Suffrage, Women's Long Fight for the Vote, and Dr. Christian Nunez, recently elected president of the National Organization for Women, our largest feminist organization, and only the second African-American woman to hold that position. She'll speak about how the current attacks on voting rights are having a disproportionate effect on women exercising the vote that they fought so long to achieve. That's Thursday, August 26th at 5 to 6 p.m. Let's celebrate and prepare to finish what we started.
Women are wanting to vote.
To all the low riders, the big riders. What happened in the car, yo?
This is Mama Soul. I, the Law, and DJ Black Icon 11111 want you to ride along with us, the Harlem Connection. We've got your soundtrack for Wind in Your Hair, groove-filled summer drive. So join us this Friday, 10 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and WBAI.org. If you missed an episode or want to replay one, check out the Harlem Connection on the WBAI archives.
Beep, beep, who got the keys to the Jeep? Vroom.
A station dedicated to and sponsored by its listeners. From 1960 to present day, WBAI has been promoting an innovative perspective of news, public affairs, music, arts, health, and science. In order to provide a truly unique voice to New York City, WBAI receives its financial assistance from listeners like you. To help WBAI continue this tradition, you can become a BAI buddy by giving a generous monthly donation of as little as $10. It's a safe, secure, and simple way to support your local station. To become a BAI buddy, go to give to WBAI.org. That's give the number to WBAI.org.
The previous program was Off the Hook, heard Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Exploration with Michio Kaku. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science. And today, we're going to talk about the impact of science and technology on people. That is, you and me. But first, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science, politics, and things that affect your life. First of all, you can't help but notice that lessons from Afghanistan are being written even as we speak. The world was shocked by photographs and videotapes coming out of Afghanistan, heartbreaking photographs and videos showing the signs of desperation as thousands of people tried to flood into the airports. A whole nation was collapsing right before your eyes. But what does it all mean? When historians write the lessons learned from Afghanistan, what are they going to say? Well, first of all, let me say that I saw something similar when I was in the Army. I was in the United States Army from 1968 to 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War. And the Vietnamese Army also collapsed within a matter of weeks to days. And the question is, why? Why did it happen? That's not the way battles are supposed to be won and fought, according to the textbooks. What went wrong? Well, of course, historians are going to write books about this, but I'll add my two cents worth about the meaning of what happened in Afghanistan. And also, in the news, the Delta variant once again is dominating the headlines. The Delta variant, as I mentioned, is about 60% more contagious than the Alpha variant, which in turn is more contagious and lethal than the original coronavirus that started this whole panic. And in some sense, we are witnessing our Darwinian principle, survival of the fittest. It turns out that 98%, just within a matter of a few months, 98% of all coronavirus victims in the United States suffer from the Delta variant. So we're literally seeing Darwinian principles at work. So what are we going to do about it? On one hand, there's some people that say that come late September, that's when people can get a third shot of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. Even though, of course, we're still moving into uncharted territories, it's better than getting the virus itself. But we'll say a few things about the fact that there could be new variations also coming in the distance. This means that we have to continually be on guard, because these viruses evolve, just like the way Darwin said. And then let me say a few things about fusion power, which is dominating some of the headlines. Out of California, the Livermore National Laboratory, where we design hydrogen bombs, it turns out that a huge, gigantic fusion reactor broke records and at least 10 quadrillion watts of power in a single burst of energy. And already the newspapers are making breathless articles saying perhaps fusion, the ultimate source of energy, is at hand. And what does that mean? Well, first of all, I think a lot of these reports are exaggerated. But yes, a milestone was reached last week at the Livermore National Laboratories. And we'll talk about what is fusion. Is fusion the white knight that's going to save us from global warming? Or is it going to be another disappointment? Well, we'll talk about that on Exploration. Well, once again, leading off, we're going to say a few things about the heartbreaking photographs and videos coming out of Afghanistan, especially for those individuals that worked with the United States military during the past 20 years of occupation. They fear for their lives. And it's incredible. Within a matter of just days, a military with hundreds of thousands of troops, armed with the Navy, armed with an Air Force, armed with some of the most advanced military equipment, collapsed within a matter of just days, catching, well, pretty much everyone off guard. But the question is, what are the roots of that? Well, as I mentioned, historians are going to write books going into years from now, trying to tease apart the meaning behind all of this. So I'd like to give my personal spin on the subject, which of course cannot do full justice to the enormous historical forces at work here. First of all, I was in the military. I was in the military from 1968 to 1970 in the United States Infantry. Not Signal Corps, not armor, not artillery, no, the grunts, the infantry, the people that actually do the dirty work of occupying enemy territories. And I learned a few things by being in the military. One thing I learned in the military is, well, the United States always wins wars. We have overwhelming military superiority. Why did we win World War II? Well, yes, a lot of it had to do with the bravery of U.S. soldiers, but perhaps the bulk of the reason why we won World War II is overwhelming firepower. We have a huge economic engine that on a turn of a dime can stop making Ford motor cars and Chevrolets and start making tanks and weapons of mass destruction. So this country, well, let's face it, we don't lose wars, we win wars. However, the real question is, can we win the peace? And that's where things begin to fall apart. Yes, we have the boots on the ground, but do we have the suits? The suits who understand the hearts and minds of the people that we are going to occupy. Now, if you compare the Taliban with the United States Army, there's just no contest. The Afghan army had over 300,000 well-armed, well-trained troops. They had advanced equipment. They had the latest in machine guns and firepower and drones. And what did the Taliban have in contrast? They had a ragtag bunch of unofficial people that barely learned how to shoot an AK-47, but there they were. There they were fighting us to the draw. I mean, what's the difference? The difference is, well, among other things, motivation. The Taliban were fighting for something. We were fighting to just hold time and try to knock off as many terrorist cells as we could. But the average Taliban troops, they weren't sophisticated fighters. No, they were country boys taken right out of the fields, given a gun, and they were fighting for something. Some of them said that they were fighting for their country. Yes, you see, Afghanistan has a nickname, the graveyard for empires. You have to go back to Alexander the Great. You have to go back thousands of years to see the history of this war-torn nation. Yes, it's easy to occupy Afghanistan. Yes, it's easy to defeat a ragtime, disorganized military that is not trained, ill-equipped, but they have one thing going for them, and that is motivation. They're fighting for something. Rightly or wrongly, they believe that they're fighting for their people. And that's why, even without firing a single shot, village after village, region after region, in fact, the whole nation of Afghanistan itself fell, collapsed without firing a shot. What happened was the troops simply put down their weapons and changed into civilian clothes, and the military blended into the peasant population. What happened to all that military training? What happened to the Navy, the Air Force, the high-tech equipment? All of that was no match against an army that was ill-equipped, illiterate, and could barely put up a fight, push comes to shove. But we did not win their hearts and minds. And yes, you can win the wars, but you can lose the peace. And I think that's what happened here in Afghanistan. We failed to win over the people. Now, we definitely made progress. We definitely tried to educate people in the countryside. We tried to introduce women's rights. We tried, but we missed the boat. Because we have to understand the mind of a teenager in the hills of Afghanistan who picks up an AK-47 and wants to take on the greatest military power that the world has ever seen. You know, when I was in the Army, every soldier has to ask one question. You can forget about all the saluting and all the jargon that we have to memorize. Every soldier has to ask one question, and that is, are you willing to die for this cause? I had to ask that question to myself. I had to say that when I pick up an M14 or an M16, am I willing to fight and die for my country because this is something I believed in? Well, unfortunately for the United States, many of the Taliban troops came to the conclusion that they were simply not willing to die. In fact, not even willing to fight for a cause that they did not necessarily believe in. So it's something to think about. And that is, if you have an army, even with modern equipment, that's held together by a paycheck, it's no match if they pit it against local infantries that know the territory, that are willing to blend in with the countryside and the people and take on some of the greatest military forces in the world. Well, as Mao Zedong used to say, if you're going to fight a guerrilla war, you have to be like fish in an ocean. The ocean being the people, the peasants, the people who make up the bulk of your country. And the fish are the guerrilla fighters. And who's going to win? Well,